This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Today is going to be a single data story with a little bit of stage setting to try to give an example rather than an exhaustive overview of how technology is likely to be changing healthcare in the near future. So I'm Benjamin Sparn. I'm a professor between HDSI, the Hollis Jobin Data Science Institute, and the Bioengineering Department at UCSD. A lot of my work has been in neuroendocrine regulation of biological rhythms. So things like your daily rhythm or women's menstrual rhythms or seasonal rhythms. Historically, this has been hard to study, and I'll say more about that later. What's exciting is these patterns are becoming more clear, and we can look for that kind of pattern specifically in healthy and unhealthy aging cohorts to learn more about how aging happens for real people in the real world. I show this little image, the wave, because oftentimes the growing aging population, especially in the US, is referred to as the silver tsunami. So let's look at that and get our first data for the evening going. So this is a graph of data of the percent of the population over here on the y-axis against the year. And we see we go into the future here. So this is a projection of expected population. And specifically, this is people over 65, which is a broad group, of course. And this is from the UN. So it's a fairly trustworthy source, we hope. I like this particular graph because it does a nice job of illustrating the sort of growing wave-like nature. This is, of course, echoing the emergence of the baby boom and that large demographic surge that happened with the emergence of these of this generation. Now, one of the things that should be obvious is this is a major demographic shift. If we look at the percentage here, we're going from percentage of the population more than doubling. Within the United States, this is estimated to take us from where we are right now, which is a little bit south of 50 million people in this category, to north of 80 million in just the next 25 years. That is a major demographic shift. That's a lot of people moving into that category. This causes concerns in lots of arenas. Today, we'll focus on this idea of how can we do that sustainably within the medical system? So I highlight this idea of medical costs. If we think about how much money goes into everybody as they age, you've probably heard statistics like the 90% of costs in health are within the last few years of life. This holds true. And so what that means is that we have expected large numbers of people moving into the part of their life which is the most expensive from a healthcare point of view. Our healthcare system in this country already has trouble keeping up. So as that many more people create that much more medical need as they age and develop aging-associated conditions, we need to start figuring out, and in fact, we're probably behind the ball at this point, how can we scale our medical systems to ensure that we're increasing the quality of life of people as they move into this larger age demographic? Of course, I'm going to suggest some various technologies that might make that easier, but let's stick with this thread for now. It may be the case that a lot of technologies can expand even beyond this demographic surge so that lifespan increases, so that maybe I'm going to live to be 110, although my grandparents died in their 70s and 80s and 90s. Aside from longevity, though, there's this concept of health span. We don't want to really just exist for as long as possible if that existence isn't a satisfying existence. We really want to maintain this concept of health span, which is to say we really want to stay, you know, able to do the things we want to do for as many of the years that we're alive as possible. There's actually good emerging evidence that longevity may have a ceiling. We may not just be able to make people live arbitrarily longer. Instead, what we might be able to do is we might be able to help people to live healthy longer. A very important component of that is being able to get into preventive medicine. So a huge hope for a lot of emerging technologies like those that I will give an example of today have less to do with, can we make it so you never get cancer, develop Alzheimer's, something terminal. Rather, the expectation is that at some point, something will cause the end of life. What we want to do is we want to prevent the degradation of health quality as long as possible across that life. So we want to really think about technologies that help us prevent the things that are going to not only create a personal burden, but create a caregiver burden, create a medical system burden. If we can reduce by prevention a lot of these large things that come up, like dementia, like cancer, then we're staving off and we're reducing a lot of those associated costs, which means the care and the support that's available can be spread around more people more effectively. So that's very important to try to understand. How do we increase prevention? And of course, you can't really prevent something if you don't know who's at risk, if you don't know whom you're targeting with preventions. And so this gets to this idea of screening. How is it that we can use technologies to enhance our ability to detect where is the problem going wrong so that we can target resources more efficiently to those people so that without having to all of a sudden have two or three times as many hospitals, two and three times as many doctors, two and three times as many drugs, instead those resources are spread, guided by intelligence systems, AI, ML, driven systems that are looking through lots of data that we're now generating, figuring out who's showing risk signs of maybe developing something down the line, and helping us to target those prevention resources to the right people early to maximize their efficacy. If you think about your own interaction with the health system, you probably don't think about spending a whole lot of time in the hospital. Hopefully that's the case for you still. All of us may get there at some point, but we all basically want to not see the doctor as much as possible. And so, if we're relying on a classic clinical standard, a blood test, for example, that may not be able to provide the kind of large continuous screening that's ideal for early detection. We wouldn't probably go in and get a blood test for something if we have no reason to worry that we have the thing. As a result, we want to think about, well, what's going to give us that insight? What's going to provide that screening that lets us target these resources more effectively into the future? And that's where this idea of the Internet of Things becomes very important. So here's a cartoon from my alma mater, Santa Cruz, and they do a nice job of showing the variety of different kinds of objects that are incorporated with this idea of the Internet of Things. And fundamentally, you know this colloquially as like, isn't it weird that my refrigerator has a computer chip in it? Why is my toaster on the Wi-Fi? In fact, there's a lot of very useful information that comes off of devices like this. So if we stick with, for example, the toaster, silly example clearly, and yet, if there was a clinician watching how often are you using the toaster, just that would give them a lot of information. They might have a sense of how many carbs are you consuming and is that in line with your preferred diet? More, because it's your toaster, they can see patterns of change across time and they might say, gee, I've noticed you've started making toast at 3 a.m. sometimes. That's a little concerning. You know, most people make toast when they wake up in the morning. Are you waking up super early in the morning? And is that itself a concern that we should talk about? So the theme here is that without any extra work on our part, a lot of the infrastructure around us, our homes and devices on our bodies, some of these devices like the ring just on top of the roof there represent wearable devices, wearables as an industry that's emerging. These are generating vastly more knowledge about us than the hospitals have ever been able to do. If you think about a wearable device, I'm wearing an Oura Ring. If you have maybe an Apple Watch or a Fitbit, there's a lot of these devices now, and the market will continue to diversify, I'm sure. Some people have diabetes. They use continuous glucose monitors. What you can think about is, how often would I have to go to the doctor for them to have the level of insight that this device generates? These devices often generate data every second, every minute, and they often do it on multiple physiological modalities. So maybe they get some sleep tracking. Maybe they look at your steps. Maybe they look at your heart rate. In the case of the Oura Ring, which is a device that I've liked for many years, the reason I like it in large part is because it tracks temperature. And temperature, it turns out, gives us a lot of information not only about sleep, but about hormonal changes and changes of other biological rhythms that matter a lot for health. So one hopeful thing that we can start to think about aspirationally is the fact that there's so much more data becoming available right as there's so many more people becoming elderly and needing more care. There's an opportunity to pair those two things and to say, these data are going to give us an opportunity to see this aging population who may need more care with a level of clarity that has never been historically possible, nothing close to it. So the challenge then is for us to figure out how do we leverage those data to do the maximum amount of good for the maximum number of people. So again, I want to try to tell you a data story as an example of where we can use this kind of screening technology that's emerging already. To do that, I want to talk about sleep. I've mentioned daily rhythms. I've mentioned this idea of your toaster betraying the fact that you're getting up to snack at 3 a.m. Our daily rhythms are really important to our health. So this is a figure that I've taken from a paper where I give a notification in the bottom right hand. I really like this figure that they generated, and I've added the sun and the moon to try to clarify what's happening here. What they're saying is two things. One, for any given medical effect, in their case, they're looking at recoveries from treatments, we expect people's temperatures in their core, so your sort of your body temperature, to have this nice daily rhythm. And you can see that cartooned in the dashed line, the sine wave. So we're looking at your core temperature, what you would take with a oral thermometer, for example. And then we're looking at time of day across the bottom. We're going from the day into the night, back into the morning. And we're seeing that there's this expected variance. We'll talk a lot about the importance of that variance, the importance of that shape of change. Importantly, what they also show is an individual's data underneath that perfect sine wave, because none of us are exactly what's in the textbook. None of us are exactly the average person. More importantly, none of us have exactly the same day over and over again. Even in Groundhog Day, Bill Murray changes, right? So here what they're showing is that difference. There's this nice cartoon of a sine wave, this idea of a regular rhythm, and yet there's this acknowledgement that individuals have differences in these rhythms day to day. Now, the more that those rhythms are similar, the more that you have a routine, and the more that they match this daily rhythm, likely the healthier you are. So right away, one thing we can start to be aspirational about is if we could see this daily rhythm on individuals and we could follow it across time, maybe we could see changes that tell us that that health state is also changing. In fact, this is exactly what my lab has done. We took a lot of wearable data from volunteers around the world. And when COVID was starting in 2020 and into 2021, we were developing algorithms to detect changes in the shape of the day of temperature like this. And we got to the point where we could tell people that they seem like they're getting sick and possibly this is COVID. Maybe you should isolate. Maybe you should go to test. As much as 2.5 days before they actually were able to get a test and get a diagnosis. Because the shape of this day as they became inflamed or developed a fever was clear within the data, even if it wasn't obviously felt by them, and even if it wasn't severe enough that they wanted to go seek out medical care yet. So this shape of the day is going to give us a lot of insights. One thing that I want to highlight is that we've learned now by using these wearable devices that while core temperature gets hotter during the day and then gets cooler to help you stay asleep, part of the way it gets cooler at night is that it dumps that heat through your skin, which means that skin temperature tends to be the opposite of core temperature. They both get hotter when you have a fever. For those interested, they both get hotter after a woman ovulates. But in the daily rhythm, they tend to be opposites of each other. So when we look at sleep from wearable devices, we tend to see that skin temperature is hotter at night, and that's partly representing this loss of heat from the core, which is being put through all your capillary beds and dumped out into space through your skin, and we register that loss of heat. So one other thing we can see is that this gets cooler during the night. Well, what if I take sleep during the daytime? It turns out that when you take a nap and you sleep during the daytime, your temperature also dips. And so this gives us a nice sign of how much are people feeling the need to sleep during the daytime, how consistent is their sleep during the nighttime. Sleep changes are very important signs of healthy aging. And so I can illustrate that here with a figure that I've lifted from Dr. Cronley's blog. It's a very nice blog explaining science, referenced there at the bottom of the slide. So this is a cartoon of what sleep looks like for a younger and more importantly, a healthy individual. What we see is that there are these several stages along the y-axis. You're awake, and that's this dark purple. And then you drop through these layers of sleep. You sort of drop down through stage one, stage two, stage three, stage four. Stage three, stage four, these tend to be called deep sleep. And then you have these cycles. So if you look at the architecture of these shapes, they're not random. It dips down, it peaks back up, dips down, peaks back up. It makes these waves across the night. These are called sleep cycles. They're very important. And the structure of them tells us that this person has these nice stable cycles. They're heavier in deep sleep at the beginning of the night. They're heavier in REM sleep at the end of the night with those pink highlighted bars. And that's exactly what we expect. There's a trade-off across the night, but it's nicely structured. If somebody is showing signs of unhealthy aging, one of the risk signs they show is that that sleep starts to break down. It's sleep fracturing is what we call this. So here, if we look at this person on the bottom, we can see that their night looks very different. It looks very broken up. It looks like a sign that they're heading in the wrong direction, or maybe they're already there. This is very hard for your body to maintain health when it can't get those nice sleep cycles. And so one of the challenges is to say, could we see patterns like this in people? And of course, could we see signs not just during sleep, but during the day? Because when you have a night like this person's having on the bottom, you really aren't that refreshed, which means you probably want to catch up during the day. You want to take more naps. And so this idea of tracking sleep, tracking rhythms, tracking these patterns, these shapes of change across the day and the night, starts to give us an insight into where this kind of Internet of Things, and especially wearable technologies, are going to help us develop screens for changes like this across time. So let's talk about naps a little bit. Naps can be a good thing. In fact, historically, naps were totally normal. The fact that we don't sort of take for granted that we should all be taking a nap in this particular place, in this Western culture, is really quite modern. It's an artifact of industrialization and wanting people to work from 9 to 5. And that has spread across the world so that we see that this culture of taking a nap or a siesta, whatever you like, that used to be very pervasive, and it's dying out as globalization spreads. What that means is that there's lots of reasons why taking a nap shouldn't be something that worries you. And I certainly don't want to leave you with the impression that if you took a nap, that's bad. That's not the case. Naps can be great. In fact, naps refresh you. Naps can help you consolidate your memories and your emotions so that you can actually be as alert after a half-hour nap as you are when you wake up in the morning, if it's a good nap, if it's a well-timed nap. The problem arises when these naps are not good naps. So naps can also be a risk sign. And this is contrasting this image here. This person isn't resting in a hammock. They didn't say, yeah, it's time for my siesta. I'm going to go lay out in the sun, feel happy. They were trying to do something. They were reading. They were trying to work, but they just didn't get a good night's sleep. They have this sleep pressure built up inside the building. And as a result, uncontrollably, they're falling asleep during the day. And this is a sort of a sign which, if we see it over time, tells us that there's something bad happening, that this person's body is not keeping up, and we should worry about their health. We might want to think about an intervention to try to help them get back on track. If they can recover their sleep, they might do very well. But if this continues, this could definitely be a risk sign for the development of things like Alzheimer's and related dementias down the line. So the data story I want to tell you today is about naps. It's about this idea that we could use temperature from wearable devices to look at how naps and sleep happen during the day with a resolution that's never been seen before. But more importantly than that, that resolution lets us follow people across time so that you can conceive of not just on average, is napping good or bad, which is hard to tell, any individual nap, was that a good nap or a bad nap? It's hard to know. Rather, can you follow yourself across time by using these technologies so that we can imagine developing screens for the emergence of sleep disruption as a risk factor very early on before things like dementias develop? So let's get into some data here. Right now, what we're looking at is distal temperature, so skin temperature, as opposed to core temperature. And just as I warned you, we see that it's the opposite of what we saw. So we have sleep, where it's very, very warm. Again, this is your skin dumping all of that heat from your core to help your core cool down. That makes your skin hotter. And then we have wake along here. Here I'm cartooning it in noon, but you can see this waterfall at the left edge is really people waking up. People are then awake into the day, and that temperature goes back up as they fall asleep in the evening. Now, of course, what you might notice is that it's not just a flat line. It's not a perfect sine wave, nor is it just a light switch on and off. But there's sort of waves to it. Specifically, there's this wave we see around 1400, 1600, so 2 to 4 in the afternoon, which we hypothesize might be an indication of sleep. And I'll show you that that seems to be the case. Before we go there, though, we also see that there's this stripiness. You might wonder what that is. This is different decades of life averaged across people that were extracted and analyzed from this very large COVID study that we did. The study involved tens of thousands of volunteers. And so while this is not COVID itself, it helps us understand the physiology that makes people different from each other so that we can make better algorithms like COVID, like Alzheimer's detection, like sleep disruption detection, across these very diverse populations of people. So here the lens on diversity we're using is age, and we're seeing that as people get older, we're coloring those lines darker purple in this case, they're getting warmer and warmer during the day. Not all of that may be related to sleep. It's also the case that as people age, they tend to lose a little bit of control of their capillaries, the vascular muscles that keep your blood vessels tight. These tend to wear out a little bit over time. And so we expect that people feel a little colder as they get older, and that this also registers in our wearable devices as more loss of heat through the skin. So we see that loss of heat as heat being picked up by these wearable devices, so warming in this case. Person feels cold because they're losing heat. The device picks up that lost heat, so the device thinks it's hotter. So we can think about already, how is this different than what we knew in the past? Well, in the past, we would have taken our temperature with a thermometer. This is a Kinsta thermometer. These were one of the smart thermometers that was deployed early in the COVID pandemic to great effect. They figured out that even though this is just taking your temperature once a day, this was sold to women tracking their cycle and seeing when they get hot and knowing that they've ovulated. But people had this thermometer. They were taking their temperature every day. And Kinsta said, hey, that's cool. While there's this pandemic happening and people are getting inflammation and fevers, maybe we can just look at where are those temperatures hotter than they should be on average, county by county, and we can create a daily risk map. And they actually did this, and this was useful for researchers. This was useful for the CDC. We had a lot of people around the country saying, you know, it looks like I'm getting hotter today. And Kinsta could say, oh, it looks like lots of people in your area are getting hotter today. You know, that's not good. Maybe more people are getting sick. The problem, though, is that if that's only one measurement a day, we don't see these beautiful shapes. We don't see these beautiful waves. We don't know where we are in those. We only have the one number. And so we can't really see these subtle changes across the day in the same way. By contrast, once again, by using a wearable device, here pictured the Oura Ring so you can see some little sensors inside it. It's small, it's worn, it's a thing people tend to put on and then forget about. And it therefore is able to generate temperature measurements every minute, all of the time, every day, continuously. And so again, as this kind of technology becomes more available, we can expect not to say on average what is somebody's temperature at some time during the day, but specifically, what are these shapes across the day, across days, and how is that changing? So if we focus on the two extremes in this line, if we look at naps, first let's talk about knowing this is really sleep. If we look at when are all of these different groups more likely to sleep during the day, so we're excluding nighttime sleep, we're just looking at islands of sleep during the day here, we see that there's this large rise in propensity to sleep right at when that temperature bubble is happening, right when that little wave is going up. So this really lines up with our expectation. We see this rise of temperature in the afternoon. It correlates very well with napping. We already know from the scientific literature that when people sleep, they show these temperature changes. So this gives us good confidence that, in fact, these temperature changes are indicating something like sleep pressure. So if we go back and we focus on the two extremes in this group, the youngest and the oldest, we can start to imagine a story of tracking somebody where we say, okay, on average, people above 70 look more like this pink line on any given day. On average, people who are in their 20s or 30s look more like this light blue line every day. But people are very different from each other. People have different behavioral patterns. People have different health conditions. It's really not reasonable to say everybody should look like one of these. Instead, what we might want to say is, could we follow people across their health journeys and try to figure out, are they looking more or less like one of these as they age? Remember, the first wearable devices that were commercially viable, that were really a big deal, didn't emerge until around 2013, 2014. So we've only lived with technologies like this for about 10 years, and many of those years without wide adoption. But we can expect to look to a future where they become much more common, they become integrated into our lives, they become cheaper, more people gain access. And so we can imagine saying, okay, well, I've only got a few days, months, years of my own data, but I can expect to see more data from myself as I age in this new tech-enabled world. Am I looking more pink as I age? Am I staying blue? Let's cartoon that out with a little bit more clarity. So we'll move this over to the side a little bit. We're not worrying about the axes or the specific numbers. We're worrying about the similarity of the shapes. When one starts to build a health algorithm, you're trying to get what I affectionately refer to as the robot, but some computer algorithm, some computer series of steps, to look at this shape the way that you do. And as a human, you're very good at this. You look at this shape and you go, oh, Hank is clearly higher in the day. It's sort of sloping up a little bit more aggressively, maybe sloping up a little earlier. The machine has no intuition for anything. So you have to help it see these patterns. And we do that by what we call featureizing these things. So we might make a feature, which is, what's your average temperature during the day? We might make a feature, which is, what's your average temperature at night? We might make a feature, which is, how early do you start that ramp back up to sleep? We might add features, like each of those can be described within the day or across days as an average. But we expect they vary day to day. So maybe that variability is important. Maybe we would say, what's the variability of how hot are you during the day? What's the variability of how hot are you at night? So already now we've imagined, sort of cartooned out six features together. Each of those will have some statistics to it. Each of those will change over time. We can imagine many more. And in fact, in my lab, what we tend to do is say, those are a kind of feature called an explainable feature because they're derived by us. They're not made up by the machine through some series of transformations that we can't see. They make sense. They have some physiological meaning. But there might be lots of them that have physiological meaning, and we tend to use between 50 and 100 features in our larger algorithms. All of them are explainable, all of them make some sense, but they capture different kinds of change or different times of day, different kinds of shape, different kinds of wiggle. Now, I might take any two of those. I might say, well, here's how hot you get at night, here's how hot you get during the day, and I could make a graph and I could look at the regression of those two across time. Do they show a stable relationship? When one gets hotter, does the other get hotter, vice versa? I could add a third, and I could have a 3D graph, and it's a little harder to look at, but I could spin it around on my computer, I could look at it. Once we get past three dimensions, we really don't have a good way of looking at these data. And that's, again, where these emergence of large machine learning models, large AI models, become extremely helpful, because the computer has no problem looking at all of these dimensions at once. And so we can say, here's 75 features. Each one is its own dimension. Across all of them, in interesting combinations, there's probably relationships that do a better job of telling me who's like whom, whose day was more similar to who, who's stably or changing in a way similar to whom. I can't see all of those relationships myself as a human, but I can mathematically describe the kind of relationship I want and get the computer to project through all of those different dimensions, all of those different features, down to sort of a shadow of that very nebulous data space, back into the 2D where I can see it. And I'm not going to try to show you very complex versions of that. I want to show you a simple cartoon so that you can get the concept of it. What are these machines seeing that we can see also? So we might imagine that we can place an individual person on an individual day, and there they are. And we go, okay, you're a point in space. What the axes are really doesn't matter. It's some mathematical construction of all these different features. It doesn't matter. It gives us a relative position. And what we're going to care about is, how similar am I to myself over time, or do other people like me? So here's this other person. Well, they're pretty similar. Here's this other person, and well, they're a little less similar. They're farther away. Begs the question, how do we know how far is too far? How do we know what's a reasonable distance? And we get this from context. So we can look at, in our case, tens of thousands of people over millions of nights. And we can start to say, okay, there's, in fact, because of all of these features, all of these numbers, we have what's called a numerical landscape. So we're looking down on this kind of like a map of Yosemite if we wanted to go camping. And we're saying, okay, there's some dense parts. Those maybe are mountains. There's some sparse parts. Maybe those are oceans around our island. What we want to know is, who lives where on this island that we've created? And as I walk through my journey of life, where am I? Am I walking towards an area that's associated with good outcomes? Or am I walking towards an area associated with the emergence of dementia, for example? So let's think about that. We've got this pink group, we've got this blue group. We can numerically say who's closest to pink and who's closest to blue. And we can say, before we do that, let's divide this landscape up by what we already know. We know some of these people on paper are older than, in this case, 70 years old. So we can segregate the demographic category, in this case, age, and we know where that older part of the landscape segregates in this case. We can then overlay that and we can say, well, some of those people who are in that older population are definitely looking very similar to this pink group. So we can cluster them computationally, and we can say those people look pretty pink. Similarly, at the other end of the island, here's all these people that are much younger. And sure enough, when we ask the computer to place them in the map, it goes, yeah, they're pretty close to that blue part. Everybody else maybe is somewhere in between. They're not quite blue, they're not quite pink, but we can see as they age their progression across this landscape. And again, the idea here is that if every point is an individual and a day, as you accumulate days, you can start to stack up, where am I relative to other people? Who am I similar to? Am I similar to people that have had medical conditions that I should worry about, like sleep disruption that is maybe an early risk sign of the emergence of Alzheimer's and related dementias? What we also want to do, though, is not just think about the extremely long term, because as I said, this demographic shift is happening within the next 25 years. That's much faster than watching an entire lifetime. So what we want to do is maybe go back to this map and just dust off everybody who's too young to be very interesting for this analysis. Let's just focus on those people that are older than 70 in this case. What we can do is we can take a very similar numerical approach, and we can say some of these people, by virtue of these many features that we've identified, are going to be more similar to each other. Some are going to be more different. Without knowing what that looks like, without knowing who those groups are, would it be possible to have the computer help us sort these people into clusters, types of people, phenotypes, if you like? And can we then go backwards and associate those phenotypes with, for example, the emergence of NAPS, so that we know what's the shape of change that's going to tell us the most about the risk of napping and potentially the emergence of dementias from them? So we might have a couple of clusters pretty close to each other, right in the middle. And we go, okay, those look pretty good. Maybe that's where most people are aging, and maybe that's a good healthy baseline. Then we might have a small minority off on a small island to the side, and we say, okay, they look a little different. Let's see what's in there. Let's see what we compare it to. Or maybe on the other side, we have a different island. And that different island maybe has different risks. And we could tell if somebody's varying, are they leaning green? Are they leaning blue? Do we worry about things associated with red or things associated with gold as we look down the line? So we did this, and I can show you how these clusters shake out from these temperature data. So these are the real data now, and this is looking across thousands of individuals within our cohort older than 70. And in this case, we're only looking at individuals that had 200 nights of sleep within our record. So very well represented, very robust representations. And what we found was that there were four dominant archetypes or phenotypes of sleep and temperature rhythm across these people. So once again, we're looking at skin temperature here. And you might notice that now everybody looks like they're centered at 0 degrees. That sounds very cold. Really what we're looking at is change. So we're no longer thinking about how many degrees are you. We've normalized everybody so that their average is 0. And instead we look at the relative change as a function of the time of day. So everybody gets hotter during the night when they're sleeping. Everybody gets cooler into the day. This allows us to compare these groups against each other and say, okay, they all are on average at 0. What is it about the shapes that are telling us a story that are different, that are separating these groups? One thing that you might notice is that a lot of these groups look relatively flat across the day. If we focus on this green and blue group, for example, thinking of the middle of our cartoon cluster over on the left, you can see that they have that nice little wave of a nap, and that looks very much like what we saw earlier. But they have a dip afterwards, and they're at the end of the day and the start of the day are actually quite similar. So they wake up, they regulate their temperature quite well, they have a bit of a nap-like hump on average, but they're still doing a pretty good job regulating their day. We see that this red cluster has a little bit more pronounced hump, but it looks different. It's shifted over a little bit, and they're sleeping quite late. You see that temperature rise of red is far to the right. So this doesn't look like sleep fracturing. This looks like maybe these are people having a large lunch in retirement and enjoying their retirement. It's something different. By contrast, when we focus on this gold group, we see something that's a little more worrying. We see that their temperature regulation is a little bit loose. It gets overshot in the morning. They get too cold. And then the whole day is spent rising. When we think about this idea that the temperature rise is associated with the need physiologically for sleep, this looks very worrying. This looks like people that are feeling a lot of sleep pressure all day long. They really don't recover from that nap. It just keeps going up. So this is the kind of thing where these data can help us identify individuals in that gold group. And specifically, as they move from that green group into that gold group, that gives us an early detection of maybe your sleep is being disrupted. We can then take those data and compare it to sleep data, either with, in this case, the same device, or in the future, by targeting interventions and saying something looks wrong, you know, let's track your sleep, let's confirm that, let's make sure. So if we compare this to when are people likely to sleep during the day, like we saw earlier, once again, we see that there's a substantial difference here, that in red, they're doing very well. In blue and green, they're napping a little bit more. Consistent with what we've said, that green group is a little bit hotter than that blue group during the day, and they do nap a little bit more. But the gold group is napping substantially more than all of them. And so this apparent sleep pressure coming from temperature really is doing a reasonable job of giving us a very, very early screening sign that something is happening with these people's sleep. Notice that the nighttime temperatures still look on average similar. So this is an example of where these screening technologies enable us to leverage what we're seeing to drive resource allocation. We could target these people because of the computer's ability to recognize this shape and say, let's dig into the sleep. Let's ask them to get a sleep tracker. Let's see, are they fracturing? And the intention again is to say, because we can see not just that these shapes exist, but we can actually watch individuals day by day and score them on their similarity to these different shapes. We can create live tracking systems like the weather radar, where you can say, is a front moving in? Am I in my journey wandering into that yellow peninsula in my aging journey? And can I do an intervention and watch myself wander out of it? These things are technically now totally possible. And so it's the implementation of these in the world that is really the remaining challenge. So I'm going to pivot and end on a note about how do we think about putting these things in the world. My hope is that this idea of getting to watch yourself move across these numerical health landscapes is exciting. This was not possible with the more sparse data that we had historically, but as we all generate more data trails just ambiently because of the things we do in our lives, it becomes extremely possible, extremely fast, and that's exactly what we need to get ahead of this silver tsunami perceived burden. So you have this idea of a numerical landscape, and we can follow ourselves and say, ooh, I'm heading into that dangerous area. Let me change my diet. Let me change my sleep. Let me seek help. Let me learn how to affect my own behavior and hopefully change that course. As we start to put these things into the world, there's a few things that also need to change, not just the technology. So one thing is that only those people generating data have access to this kind of a learning. And only by comparing those people who have generated data to clinicians and researchers like myself have the ability to say, okay, for people like you, this is a good trajectory, this is a bad trajectory. Things differ by sex, they differ by age, they differ by ethnicity, they differ by where did you grow up, they differ by socioeconomic status. So it's very important to seek out and engage different communities. And it's very participatory. It really revolves around people not only generating these data, but sharing them in such a way that they can be compared to others to allow us to make these comparisons. That also means there's some safety concerns. One of the things that will make this kind of technology really efficacious in the world is that it's safe and empowering. To the extent that you just have to trust, you know, this app that I have to pay money for told me something, a lot of people, I think, reasonably will choose not to trust that, will choose not to share their data. And we will all be impoverished for that. We will all suffer for not having as good of a numerical landscape as we could have had if we'd included these other groups so that we could really more thoroughly understand the differences across people and differences across communities and make sure that every community is really getting the most precise targeting, the most precise insights tailored to their particular community needs. That means there's a lot of social work to do. We need to figure out how to be safe. We need to figure out how to implement regulations that allow audits, that allow people to know who's using their data, when is it being used effectively, which data are changing over time. All of these things are becoming really important social needs, not just sort of neat apps. And so there needs to be more social engagement to determine what is going to be a standard for safety in this way. And finally, there's a nice sort of end note here where, as a lot of people age, one of the things that becomes important, at least through my experience talking to people, is that they really want to share what's happened in their life. This is a new way to empower that sort of sharing. The more that people adopt these technologies, get involved in these conversations about community involvement, about safety, the more these stories are really captured in data. They're not lost because somebody didn't hear the words coming out of your mouth. The data are archived, the data are safe, they're available to other researchers perhaps. And so you're able to share your life experience. Hey, I went on this diet, it had this effect on me. Other people that are physiologically like you, that can be clustered like you based on these data, can see these things, can learn from each other. So this is really a revolution in medicine. Instead of just saying, what does the doctor think? These technologies really enable us to be in a position where we say, as a community, what do we think? What are we learning about ourselves? And how do we find the clinicians that are especially interested in our needs, in our community? This provides a new relationship that's richer on both sides. Doctors can engage with very informed patients. They can understand the differences between these different communities that they're serving, and they can feel more effective using the resources they have, targeting those that are most in need. So there's a very positive potential here. Technically, all of these things are already possible. And again, the challenge is largely going to be showing that they're feasible, showing that they're safe, engaging different communities, and finding ways to do that as a large super community within the US and across the world. So with that, I'm going to end my talk. I would like to say thank you to the many collaborators and funders that I work with. I will call out the Center for Circadian Biology, which is one of the global leading institutions for daily rhythms research. Of course, I want to focus on the Stein Institute, which has been leading this charge, as Dr. Glorioso said, for 40 years, trying to understand aging more thoroughly. But all of these groups collaborate very well, and many others. And it's been my great privilege to work with them to bring stories like this to you. And I hope that's left you excited about getting involved.
That's great. Thank you so much, Dr. Smart, for such a wonderful talk. I really appreciated it. It was fantastic. I learned a lot, and you made it user-friendly for people like me. Others are not well-versed in this. So Dr. Smart, we have some questions here for you. I want to get started. This one is one that I know that many women can relate to. For women, have you taken into account hot flashes? Many women I know will have hot flashes that wake them at night and then keep coming back. This is a great question.
It is a great question. Actually, for a number of years, I've been trying to find partners who want to engage on this. What we have done through community engagement, things like the quantified self, is we have used temperature trackers on women going through menopause, and we have demonstrated that we can absolutely see hot flashes. I suspect this would be very empowering. I have these stories that I hear from women that are sort of heartbreaking of, you know, I tell my doctor that I'm having these hot flashes, they're disrupting my sleep. And the doctor says, it's probably not that many, I can give you a psych referral. And that's just the exact opposite of what we want to achieve, right? These data make those experiences real. It makes it much harder for someone to be dismissive in that way. So yes, that kind of thing is absolutely possible. And that kind of research is research that I and others around the world are actively engaged in, absolutely.
Great, thank you so much. Okay, next question. What is the platform being used to discuss these data within the community? What logistics are necessary to make that happen?
I don't have a great answer for that. We as a community are even trying to define who are we as the community. The number of researchers that have really focused on what do we do with wearable sensors is quite small because, you know, they've only been around for 10 years. In fact, maybe 20 years for those of us that have focused on them as an interesting side thing, but they weren't available at scale until quite recently, which means very few people have happened to build their careers in that direction. And by chance, like I've done very fortunately, you know, caught this wave when it was early and been able to surf on it. We're still figuring out what is that community? Is it the engineers? Is it the doctors? It's of course best if it's a mix, including people from the community. So how do we build that? Where are these things? One place that I've seen a lot of this be successful is going back to this example of women's health, where women have apps that they will use to track their cycles. And they are excellent at sharing in great detail all of these physiological details, temperature, bleeding, mucus, emotions, all of these things that are very important for saying, what is this experience like for me right now? It's not well characterized. A doctor on average won't have much to tell you. But then as a community, they connect and say, oh, I have seen something like that. Try this. Oh, I've seen something like this. that kind of community empowerment is profound, right? The fact that you have these data and can see these things means you can be well ahead of the clinical standard. In fact, you almost certainly are if you've done this at all. That's great. That means that people on the clinical side can be informed by you. They can learn from these communities. What is normal? What are you seeing? But that's emerging. And so that emerges, as I try to say, you know, optimistically, by people asking questions just like you do, talking with their families, talking with their colleagues, getting involved in these processes, helping to snowball to make that normal faster.
That's great. Thank you. Does hypertension medication impact core and peripheral temperature?
Yeah, so especially peripheral temperature is largely dictated by the flow of blood through the skin, which means that when we do things that are affecting blood pressure, for example, then we're affecting the probability of sending that blood to the skin. One of the challenges, of course, is that you have high blood pressure and you also have lost vascular control, which means a lot of your capillary beds will just sort of natively be open all the time instead of squeezing down a lot. Then we expect to see that as this trend that I showed you, in fact, that as people get older, they also get more heat loss through their skin, get warmer on these devices. And so, of course, as you suggest, if we lower the blood pressure, we lower the rate of perfusion of blood through those capillaries. Hopefully, that means we reduce the amount of heat loss happening per unit time. That actual specific validation study that you point to, I don't believe has been done through skin temperature, but I would be shocked if there wasn't a signature there.
Thank you. How do you take in various environmental impacts, i.e. ambient temperature?
Yeah, really good question. I appreciate that. This is very different device to a device. So we did an early study when I was a postdoctoral fellow at Berkeley. This was in 2013, 2014. So we didn't have commercial temperature sensors available. I worked with some engineers. We built a miniature device. We wore it around for days and we looked at these patterns and said, what are we seeing? What's useful? What's not useful? And what we noticed, among many other things, was that the engineer who was building this, was a graduate student at the time, had these really impressive cold spikes at the beginning of the day and the end of the day. And he said, oh, what's that about? And we realized that it corresponded to when he was bicycling. So he would bike to work, there would be this wind shear, and the device would get chilled down from the wind shear because it wasn't really snug against his skin. Most people don't love wearing a bracelet really, really tight, right? You think about your watch band, it's sort of tight, it sort of pulls. Nobody really likes that. One of the reasons that I've liked the ring form factor over the last many years is partly that. We've done validation studies to demonstrate that, in fact, it's picking up your skin temperature very reliably. And if it's a good fit, it's not picking up the environment as much. Your finger, for example, changes shape a lot less than your wrist does over the day. Some other form factors include stickers. If you go to the hospital, oftentimes they'll put stickers on you, right? Put this big clear tegaderm that takes your hair off when they take it off. But stickers are another great way where you maintain that contact. Some people have designed earrings, some people design neck pieces. Again, as I say, I think this market will continue to expand because people are still figuring out what's the best form factor for which kind of physiological data. And as we learn what are the best places to put those sensors, then people try to figure out how to get that into the world, get that into the hospital.
Not everyone has access to wearable devices or even the internet. Will services based on tech access be biased to only those who already have the privilege? It's a great question.
Yeah, that's a really important question. Right now, unfortunately, yes. Right, if you don't have access or if you feel disenfranchised, you're not generating data. You won't have access to these. I can't affect that directly. My personal preference is to try to say, how can we learn from the people that do have these technologies to help others, like all of you in the audience, see the value of this in the future so that it's worth thinking about, gee, I really wish there was a way to get some of these disenfranchised or lower access communities. I really wish they were involved. One example, which will stick with me forever, is we were doing all of this work detecting COVID that I mentioned, and we were trying to work with the border population here south of San Diego in Imperial County. They would not talk to us. They would not meet us. They had absolutely no trust in us. They said, you want me to wear a device that's going to be tracking where I am and what I'm doing? You know, screw you. Who are you? And I understand that, right? Unfortunately, I totally get why that would feel threatening. That's really unfortunate because they had 10 times the COVID load that we had here on campus. That was not only a whole lot of suffering that we might have been able to help with, but that was also a reservoir that kept it spreading for everybody else. So some people sometimes say, you know, I got mine, what's the problem? But you live in this community with everybody else. And so the more that we can help health standards rise, the less extra disease burden and in fact also taxation burden goes towards these late stage interventions. So this kind of prevention, the more we can spread it around, the better it is for absolutely everybody.
That's great. Thank you very much. You mentioned at the beginning of your talk that naps are good. What are your thoughts about the fact that Western culture has kind of done away with naps? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I tend to think that when we used to do something all the time and now none of us do it, it's a little arrogant to presume it couldn't possibly have mattered. Of course, we've seen this in the emergence of the obesity epidemic and the emergence of the modern Western diet. And there's oceans of evidence that eating a diversity of green things helps your microbiome and your gut stay much healthier, much more diverse. And that we've just kind of done away with that because, you know, processed flour, processed sugar, processed oils, they have good shelf lives. They sit on the store shelf forever. So you have access to calories and nobody starves to death. That's great. Or very, very few people these days starve to death. That's great. The problem is the quality of those were just not the same as what we evolved to deal with. And this idea that a calorie is a calorie is a calorie sort of ignored, you know, what were humans doing previously? Well, they were sort of nibbling on lots of stuff as they wandered around. Could that have been important? Nah, it's calories. But that's silly. So I think this is a similar example. I suspect part of the reason we see so much sleep fracturing in people and that this correlates with stress and depression and eventually the emergence of things like dementias is that we're not letting people have a normal physiological regulation. One possibility is that as we do more and more things like this, where we're remote instead of all being in the same room, that lets people control their schedules a little bit more. If my students took naps during the day, I would rarely notice because I just see, are they being productive over time? But they're mostly working at the computer and I'm looking at my computer and, you know, we don't even overlap every day necessarily. So I hope that sometimes we can do those experiments and these data will show us, hey, here's this group of people that have been napping, you know, by choice, healthily. What comes along with that? Do they feel healthier? Do they maintain their health better? Do they have more energy? We can learn this from each other.
That's great. Thank you. We have time for two more questions. I'm going to finish up with these two. Does the finger ring device work reliably for those of us with Raynaud, cold hands, phenomenal?
Awesome. Really interesting question. I'm not aware of any specific validation study, but I will say, and I hope she doesn't get mad at me, my partner has Raynaud's. And so if I was the sensor, I would certainly detect that her hands had gotten very cold when she'd been outside on the walk and it was cold out. Given that what it's doing is picking up the what we call the heat flux, the loss of heat, the radiation of heat out of the skin. If you have Raynaud's and you go out on a cold day and your hand starts to, you know, look pale and get cold, it's very likely that a sensor would pick that up. And almost in the opposite way that we talked about hot flashes a minute ago, we might imagine that people with Raynaud's could document more effectively how often is this affecting me, how severely is this affecting me, and that that would really help inform prioritization of treatments.
Well, you mentioned naps are good. You inferred there is a relationship between napping and dementia. Can you expand on that?
Absolutely. So once again, there's good naps where you feel fine. It's the time of day when you want to nap. Maybe you ate a big lunch and you sleep for a half an hour. Great. You wake up feeling refreshed. You do stuff into the evening. It's when you don't want to be napping and you just feel this pressure, this sleep weight, and it's uncontrollable. That becomes, in fact, dangerous. So in drowsy driving, per capita is responsible for up to 10 times more accidents or collisions rather than is drunk driving. And yet, you know, we very rarely say, oh, I'm a little tired, I shouldn't drive. Whereas all of us know to say, you know, I've had a drink, I shouldn't drive. So this idea that the sleep sort of takes you over, that's a sign that you're not getting good sleep during the night. And that also is a sign, therefore, your body isn't recovering in the night the way it should. It's a lack of maintenance. You use a good night's sleep to do maintenance. If you're not getting that maintenance, things are going to start to wear. They're going to start to break down. And you can see that in part by seeing this increased need to nap during the day.
Okay, great. Then I will make this our last question, Dr. Smart. Has your team done any research using parameters other than temperature, like heartbeat variability, blood, O2 levels, and falls, which can be detected with wearables these days?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, fall detection is a great success story from this area. I'm glad that you mentioned that. There are a few of these services that are starting to be deployed, and I think that's fantastic. Yes, absolutely. So when we were looking for COVID, we were using around a dozen different features that we had pulled out fairly quickly. This included heart rate variability, all kinds of other things, respiration, as you mentioned, O2. So yes, absolutely. I also work in the diabetes space a certain amount, and we use continuous glucose monitors. One of the things that's really fun about this work for me is as new sensors get developed and as new populations or communities start using these sensors for their own needs, they show us a new window into physiology that we never had before. And so we cannot just say, what's your good temperature? What's your good heart rate? What's your good steps? But what's the relationship across these things? Does one predict the other? The more so, the more you're a nice, stable machine. The more that they're grinding on each other and chaotic, even if individually they don't look wrong, right? Your temperature isn't high. It's just no longer related to your heart rate. That's a problem. That means internally you're not coordinating well. And so we can start to find that kind of networks of physiological features and gain these new insights into how is your body doing that? What are the hormones regulating that? And then again, what are the behaviors that help us affect them to maintain health? Great question.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Smart, for kicking off our 2024 lecture series. If you're interested in supporting the work that we do at the Stein Institute or just learning more about us, you can find us at aging.ucsd.edu. So with that, I'd really like to thank you for your time tonight. Dr. Smart, it was fantastic. And thanks all of you who attended. And we'll see you all again in March.
Thank you very much, everybody.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.